irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to The Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to welcome you to the post-diet revolution. That's right, revolution. We are going to liberate ourselves from old ideas and find new ways to make peace with food and feel better for good. And I am very excited to have Dr. Adrienne Udeem here back as a returning guest here on the show. She is going to answer your questions about anything related to health and dieting from a medical perspective. Now, let me tell you a little bit about my guest. You may have seen Dr. Udeem when she appeared on Dr. Phil. She's board certified and a diplomat of the American Board of Internal Medicine, the National Board of Physician Nutrition Specialists, and the American Board of Obesity Medicine, as well as a fellow of the American College of Physicians. She has a lot of letters after her name. Numbers. Where did that come from? She is also currently Associate Professor of Medicine at UCLA School of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Medicine at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Wow. So welcome back, Dr. Udeem.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
It's great to have you back. So I let people know, my listeners and subscribers, I let them know that you were coming back, and some people wrote in and said that they have some questions for you. So I'm going to just start with, let's just dive right in.
Perfect.
Okay, so the first question comes from Robin, and she says, what's the truth about honey? She says, I've given up processed sugar, but I have included honey in my diet in small amounts, like in homemade salad dressing or whole grain muffins. Is it just as bad as using regular sugar? That is a great question, Robin.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for your question. Yeah, it is a great question. So honey is actually a natural substance. It is made up of natural sugars, including glucose and fructose. From a caloric perspective, it's comparable to sugar. It's about 60 calories per teaspoon. And depending on the type of honey that you use, it can have a high glycemic index, which is not necessarily in your favor. A glycemic index is basically the rate at which your blood sugar rises when you consume a food. The faster that your blood sugar rises, the less favorable that is for your health. That having been said, I think it's a great substitute for table sugar because it does have some nutritional value. It isn't just the sugars that are in honey, but there's also antioxidants. There are some vitamins and minerals, bee pollen, which has some health benefits. And again, let's be kind of realistic. People use honey in moderation, and using small amounts of honey is fine if that's what your taste desires. When we talk about simple sugars and ridding our diet of sugar, we're talking about cans of soda, bars of chocolate, cookies and donuts. We're not talking about a teaspoon of honey in our dressing or in our tea. So I'm all in favor of using it if that floats your boat.
So there you go, Robin. Have honey without guilt. Actually, that makes me, you just brought up sweeteners. So what about artificial sweeteners? Because there's a lot of studies that are coming out now that show that if you drink artificial sweeteners, they actually have a very different reaction in your body than what you might expect. People think, oh, it's zero calories, so it's all good. But talk to us more about that, because my understanding now is that it's well, forget the chemicals, that's bad too, but like your body actually processes it as if it were really sugar.
So it's interesting, and the studies and the data on artificial sugars are inconclusive, so it's hard to say kind of definitively the final word. But I will say this. First of all, artificial sugars is a category that is comprised of very different things. We have saccharin, for example, which is a chemically based artificial sugar that's been man-made or created. We also have what's considered also an artificial sugar sweetener, which is plant-based, like stevia, for example. So there is variability in what we're talking about, and different compounds are going to act differently. But this is what we think. We believe that in the case of the chemically created artificial sugars, it's playing kind of a trick on your brain because it is acting like sugar. However, it's not delivering the sugar. And so some studies suggest that maybe this brain trick makes you more likely to crave sugar. There have also been studies that have linked artificial sugars to a higher rate of obesity. I'm not certain what that correlation is. It may just be that people who are trying to lose weight are consuming artificial sugars more. So again, I don't know what to say about that definitively. But again, I advocate for moderation. I think that if you can use a soda, for example, that is a low calorie or a no calorie on occasion to help curb that craving, it's okay. But used in excess, there's probably are harms, including the fact that it is promoting these cravings and wanting of sugar.
Yeah, interesting. I find that my patients, when they give up diet drinks, also just not only do they feel better because they're no longer drinking chemicals, but they all, and this is completely anecdotal, they all lose weight just by giving up diet drinks.
Well, again, I think it promotes a mindset, if nothing else, of replacing this desire. Whereas if you just kind of think of eating and drinking healthily, it is a different mindset that does promote long-term weight loss overall.
Yeah. Well, I also want to add for you guys out there, if you want to join the conversation and ask Dr. Udeem any of your questions, any health-related, diet-related, or weight loss-related, anything that comes to your mind that you're burning to know or just curious about, give us a call. 818-602-4929 is the number here, 818-602-4929. So, okay, I have another question. Actually, it's two questions in one from Jane. Jane asks, what is the truth about apple cider vinegar and weight loss? And what is the truth about apple cider vinegar and thyroid issues? So it's sort of one question that's related to the second question.
Yes. So apple cider vinegar tends to be one of my pet peeves. Somehow it's gotten out there that this additive can promote weight loss. I actually did a deep dive into apple cider vinegar in the medical literature to try and find out how this myth came to be. And there are some cellular studies showing that when you add apple cider vinegar to a plate full of cells, so this is very on the molecular level, it may affect the way free fatty acids are metabolized. Long story short, this is very, very different than how a human body will see and act towards apple cider vinegar. So there are clinical studies in humans, in actual people, actually show that there's no benefit. And the downside to consuming it is that there have been studies of people who've consumed it in excess and have had problems with teeth, harming the enamel and having breakage of teeth. And in more severe circumstances, people who have consumed it regularly and not in dilute amounts have burned through their esophagus and it has become a medical emergency. So again, there's no benefit to apple cider vinegar in regards to weight loss. And there potentially can be harms if it's consumed in excess.
So this is all a lot of hype and everything that people read, whether, as Jane asks, weight loss or thyroid issues, because I know there's a lot out there that apparently it does everything, including curing cancer, right? It's this magic elixir, but it just is vinegar.
Yes. You know, and I have to say, I can empathize with the desire to find remedies, to find natural remedies to many of our ailments. You know, medicine is not perfect, and we can't cure everything with FDA-approved drugs, which is what we use as physicians. And there are harms and side effects to many of the medications that we prescribe. So I genuinely understand the desire to want to do well holistically and totally advocate for that. But I also want to caution people, when something sounds too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true, right?
In all areas of life.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, I have tasted apple cider vinegar. I cannot imagine eating, drinking, guzzling enough to burn a hole in your esophagus. It's nasty. Sorry, apple cider vinegar people, but ew. Ugh.
Yeah. I don't promote it.
No, clearly not. Okay, now comes a really interesting question from Elizabeth. She says, what are your nutritional recommendations for post-bariatric surgery patients? She said there's support in the weeks and months after surgery, but not long term. What do you suggest?
Great question. And Dr. Nina and I were chatting before we started that bariatric surgery is a big, big topic. And so I want to spend a little bit of time talking about it. You know, bariatric surgery, first of all, is not one procedure. So in general, or in layman's terms, it refers to a set of procedures or surgeries that are done to help people lose weight. We do call these surgeries now metabolic in nature because they seem to have a metabolic effect. So I'll explain further. But first off, there are three bariatric surgeries that are most commonly performed in the United States. The first is the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass surgery. So gastric bypass is what we would consider the gold standard. It's been around the longest. It's probably been studied the most. And it does have the best outcomes in regards to weight loss and reduction of comorbidities, which are those diseases like diabetes that are associated with obesity. The second surgery is something called the gastric sleeve. And historically, this was a staged procedure because unlike the gastric bypass, in which there's surgical manipulation of the stomach and the intestine, the sleeve only really affects or cuts the stomach but does nothing to the intestines. So they used to use this procedure as like a stage procedure to get people to lose weight and then convert to the full gastric bypass. Well, this surgery has really gained a lot of favor because the studies have shown that it is almost equivalent to the gastric bypass in regards to weight loss and, again, reduction of comorbidity. So it's a good option for the right patient. And then the last is a surgery that was super popular in the United States called the adjustable gastric band or gastric banding that has really fallen by the wayside. There's great data that came out of Australia, actually, of people who did remarkably well with this surgery in regards to weight loss and comorbidity reduction. But we're different in the United States. And it turns out that our studies here, people aren't doing or haven't done as well. There can be a lot of complications with the band, even though it's considered a lesser surgery because they don't actually cut the stomach. So the last data that I heard was that less than 7% of procedures in the United States are the band. And most surgeons don't really advocate for it because of the lack of efficacy and the complications. So let's get back to the first two because the nutritional requirements can be the same. And again, nutrition is a big category that we have to divide up. First of all, because of the manipulation of the GI tract, basically you are reducing the size of the stomach and you're rerouting the intestines in the case of the gastric bypass, you are less likely to absorb certain nutrients. And so you can be at risk for vitamin and mineral deficiencies, but these can be obviated or prevented completely if people are compliant with the vitamin and minerals that they need to supplement. And to the point of your listener, you can't just supplement in the first few months or in the first few years. Supplementation needs to be lifelong. Otherwise, eventually people will develop vitamin and mineral deficiencies. Hmm. Some of the common deficiencies that can occur after these surgeries but can be prevented are iron deficiency. So iron comes from animal proteins. It also comes from leafy vegetables. But because of what happens to the stomach and the change in the acidity, people can become deficient in iron, which ultimately can cause many problems, including anemia. The second deficiency that's common is B12 deficiency. Now, B12 is a vitamin that is, again, very important for blood cells. So deficiency will cause anemia. but it's also very important in cognitive and neurologic function. So if people become deficient, they can get depressed, they can actually get psychotic from very severe deficiencies. But again, this can be prevented with regular supplementation. Calcium and vitamin D is also common after the surgery. Now, these are all micronutrients. When you talk about macronutrients, your guest will know that protein requirements are very important. And so dietitians and surgeons and physicians will really promote the intake of protein following gastric bypass, especially in the first year during rapid weight loss, because you don't want people to lose muscle. Mm. That may happen a little bit. We can't mitigate it 100%. But the more protein people consume, the less likely they are to lose muscle. And that is directly related to the metabolism. So if people lose a lot of muscle, then their metabolism is really going to tank, and it's going to be hard to maintain that weight.
Because muscle requires more calories just to keep going than fat does. And so when you lose muscle, your metabolism slows, essentially.
Absolutely. Your metabolism is going to slow if you lose anything, because you're just less of a person requiring less calories to live. But to your point, yes, muscle is going to burn more calories. So if you lose muscle, you will drop your metabolism more. And your body composition will change unfavorably to a higher percent body fat.
So what does one do if one is a vegetarian having gastric bypass or the sleeve?
Yeah, so vegetarians in general have a challenge or a greater challenge keeping up with their protein requirements. Unlike vegans, though, they can eat eggs. Eggs is a good source of protein. You get about 7 grams per egg. You can get protein from grains and vegetables as well. It's a very small amount in vegetables, but beans, legumes, and grains are a good source of protein. And so augmenting the diet with a cup of garbanzo beans, quinoa, farro, barley, these are all great ways to help maintain your protein intake.
And you could still have it. I know, sometimes people have issues with rice or certain things after gastric surgery. So you could still have those kinds of things.
Right. But, so, I mean, the progression of the diet is a progression. So immediately after the surgery, they are only allowed to have protein shakes, and that's really all they can tolerate. Over time, they can start augmenting their diet more and more. There are certain foods like breads, for example, that get sticky and mushy and aren't well tolerated. But beans and legumes, are fine. But again, everyone's different and everyone has to use caution in how they progress their diet.
So those recommendations really apply to the first two of the three categories. What about the lap band?
So the band, essentially what happens in the band is that a little plastic tube is placed around the stomach. And that tube or that band is connected to a tube that is connected to a port that's placed under the skin. And essentially what happens is that the practitioner will access that band by injecting through the port, injecting saline or salt water into the port. And when they inject saline into the port, it fills up that band, and as that band fills, it creates a restriction around the stomach. Mm. So if you can imagine, you have your stomach and you have this belt that is kind of holding it or restricting it. The goal of the band is to get people to slow down, because if you can imagine, if there's a belt around your stomach and you eat too quickly, you're going to regurgitate that food. But by chewing a lot, 30 plus times, and eating slowly, you allow for that smaller area of the stomach to fill and thereby feel full faster. Unfortunately, what happens is that people try and push it through, or maybe forget to eat slowly, or maybe forget to chew as much as they need to. And so something can develop in which they get constant regurgitation. There's backup of food in the esophagus, so the esophagus can actually dilate. These are just some of the potential complications. Another thing that happens is that people develop this kind of maladaptive eating pattern. They figure out the foods that can slip through.
Beating the band, I think, is the term that is used for that.
Unfortunately, the good stuff is not easy to get through. protein, you have to chew excessively well to get through the band. Even things like lettuce, if it's not chewed well, can get caught up. And so if people are not really meticulous about how they eat, it can, again, promote this consumption of the slippery stuff, the caloric drinks, the ice creams.
Will get through.
Exactly. Yeah. So it can be an effective surgery. And again, studies have shown that it can be. But you have to be really vigilant about the changes in your diet.
Yeah, and I have had so many people who have undergone these really extreme surgeries, and then they either beat the band, as they call it, or they find a way to eat more and end up gaining, you know, 100 pounds and then realize, oh my gosh, I've got to realize why I'm eating, not just focus on what I'm eating.
You know, it's so true that there has to be a comprehensive approach to the issue of weight loss. I don't want to dismiss the value of bariatric surgery or weight loss surgery or metabolic surgery, which we didn't get into why it was called that, but we can, because it can be a great tool for someone who is morbidly obese and who has failed dietary interventions and needs help. There is mortality data, meaning people who have had the surgery live longer than those who have not, if it's done the right way. Unfortunately, there's a lot of shaming in the medical community and in the lay public about people who go for these, quote, radical procedures. And I want to kind of disarm people from that taboo. It can be a very useful tool, but it has to be used the right way. And again, to your point, if there is, and there often is, a psychosocial underlying issue, it has to be addressed in a holistic fashion in order for people to really be successful.
Yeah, I know some people, they'll also say, if I didn't have the surgery, nothing could have stopped me. Like, nothing could have stopped me from eating that. But then they, I mean, for them at least, it was not enough to be stopped. And then, you know, you can have more and more milkshakes or whatever it is and gain weight. But you're right. I mean, for some people, it just is that at that point where it's actually life-saving because they cannot stop themselves.
Right. And, you know, an interesting thing happens when people gain weight physiologically and when they try and lose weight. When people try and lose weight, the hunger hormones will increase. So there's
leptin.
Hormones. There, leptin is a hormone, but there's others that GLP-1, PYY, this is released by the intestine. These are hormones that actually make you feel full. And in the case of weight loss, they drop. And there's another hormone called ghrelin that's released from the stomach that will increase when people lose weight. And that hormone specifically makes people feel hungry. So there's actually physiologic changes that promote hunger when people lose weight. The interesting point is that following the gastric bypass surgery, as well as the sleeve gastrectomy, they have found that some of these hormonal hormones change in favor of weight loss, not in favor of weight gain. So for example, GLP-1, which is a hormone that is released by the intestine and again helps us feel full, increases following these surgeries. And so that is what has given rise to this term metabolic surgery, because there's actually metabolic changes that appear to affect people's hunger level. A lot of times when people have trouble losing or maintaining their weight loss is not because they're drinking milkshakes per se, but they genuinely feel hungry.
All the time.
Right? And that's right. Physiologic. Mm. So it is interesting that these surgeries, at least, you know, in the short term, seems to change these hormones in the direction that would promote satiety or fullness and help prevent hunger.
Right. I mean, I suppose anyone who walks into my office is already pretty cognizant of the fact that there's something emotional or some coping strategy involved, that they're something's eating at them and that they realize that they have to deal with. But what you're saying is that there are also people, those who do not come into my office, who just feel hungry all the time, don't know, and as a result are eating all the time and don't know how to stop when they're starving, and that there is a hormonal metabolic reason for that constant hunger,
yeah,
which can be reversed.
Right, or the truth maybe lies somewhere in between, right?
As it often does.
Exactly. And so we don't want to give too much weight to the physiologic component and eliminate or avoid the psychosocial component. And we don't want to not address the physiology while we're addressing the psychosocial. I think, again, I go back to this holistic way of treating people, which means mind and body.
Because we are both. We can't just treat one without treating the other, really.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. So if anyone wants to join us, if you have a question, please feel free to call 818-602-4929. Now is your chance to get your questions answered by Dr. Adrian Udeem. So you treat a lot of people who have had bariatric surgery. You specialize in helping people lose weight in a healthy way. What is for you like the number one roadblock that you see in your patients, and how do you help them overcome it? I'm putting you on the spot.
Well, it is a little bit on the spot because I don't know that I can identify one. But I go back to this kind of mind-body approach. The way I manage my patients is really through a combination of all of what we have discussed. I do a lot of counseling and diet. And most people are aware of the should and the should nots in what we should eat. But there are also so many myths out there. So there is sometimes some genuine education that needs to be provided because we are bombarded with food myths, and sometimes it's hard to determine what's right from what's wrong. I counsel on, you know, movement and activity. I counsel on mindfulness and meditation. There's a lot of data that looks at the benefits of mindfulness meditation and weight maintenance. I provide medical interventions like medications if necessary. But to your point, there is sometimes this kind of mindset that I see in my patients. There's kind of an evolution of a mindset where sometimes people are really struggling with the necessary changes, and that makes it difficult to lose weight. And then there's kind of an aha moment where there's no longer a struggle, but just an acceptance of the necessary changes. And it's interesting that all those tools really become utilized fully. There's an analogy that I give my patients. You know, we all have those friends from high school or college who were super brainiacs, had a perfect memory, and didn't have to study very hard and aced all their exams. And most of us had to kind of work to get to where we needed to be. It's the same with weight loss. You know, there are those friends that we have that are super skinny, they can eat whatever they want, and that's just their lot, I guess. But most of us have to work at it. And so once we accept, just like we did in school, that we're not necessarily, you know, baby Einsteins, but that we have to work for it, there's this change in mindset, and it goes from struggle to an acceptance.
I like that analogy because so many people feel bad about themselves because they have to work at it, feel somehow as if they shouldn't, or they should have this innate ability to intuitively eat, and because they want to intuitively eat pizza, there's something wrong with them, as opposed to, well, not only looking at what's eating at them, but just normalizing that it does take work to be healthy. It takes work to treat yourself well in all ways, body and mind.
Absolutely. I mean, I really see health as a journey, and I blog about this and talk about this often, just like career, just like successful relationships. It is a journey that requires work and has ups and downs. There's times when we're great. There's times when we have weight regain and we really don't feel motivated to maintain those changes or the healthy behaviors. But ultimately, it's something that we need to work at long term. And if it is seen in that light, then the struggle is diminished and people are more likely to be successful.
How do you motivate people in terms of exercise? Because one question I get a lot, and I've had callers here who have often called and said, I know I shouldn't be doing exercise, but I just can't. And I say find something you love and then it won't feel like exercise. But it comes up so often, this sense of obligation, hard work to get out there and move your body. What do you tell people?
You know, I know I admit that I used the word should earlier. I love this quote of self-shoulding all over yourself, because should is such a loaded and judgy word. But, you know, activity doesn't have to be exercise. I don't even use the word activity anymore. I just use movement, because the body wants to move. And most people will find that when they move, they feel better. Now, that movement can be going for a walk. That movement can be a spin class at a gym. That movement can be gardening. But I think if people dig deep, they will find some form of movement that feels good to them. I'll also say that, like everything else, initiating a new routine, there's a little bit of a barrier to starting something new. And sometimes we just have to drink the Kool-Aid and do it with the confidence that if we do it long enough, we build that routine, we build that ritual, and that ritual becomes something that is, you know, helpful in our lives. So my recommendation is to make modest changes and take a tangible, a bite. Maybe it's 10 minutes, a 10-minute walk in the morning, and that's all you can do. But if you can negotiate with yourself just that 10 minutes, you're getting started, and that will build into something more.
And that's a good point, because often people will say, well, I need to go to the gym for 2 hours to make it work. And no, go, as you said, go for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. It's 10 or 15 minutes more than you would have otherwise. It's not all or nothing.
Absolutely. I have another analogy for that, actually. I have a cousin, shout out to a cousin in New York, who I love to talk to, and I find like I can never find that good 30-minute chunk of time to call her. And so sometimes we avoid reaching out because we're waiting for that perfect amount of time. Finally, a few weeks ago, I had 5 minutes and I said, let's just do it. And it was such a meaningful 5 minutes. So it's a good point that we don't need to always find that perfect chunk of time, but just some time to make it happen. And that's enough.
As you were talking, now this is a weird analogy, but I was reminded of when my daughter, who just started middle school today, oh my God, when she was about 5, she would only eat white food, like only white food, like bread with the crusts off of it. And I'm thinking like, oh my God, does my 5-year-old have some kind of disordered eating? What's going on? Only, you know, pasta with butter. What bread? Like the kid just lived on carbs.
And lovely.
Every once in a while, I'd be like, have this. It's, and she didn't know it had spinach in it. You know, I snuck some color into her diet. And I went to the pediatrician and I said, oh my God, like all she eats is white food with the occasional something with color. And he said, well, does she eat something with color like at least twice a week or 3 times a week? I'm like, yeah. But shouldn't she be doing it every day? He's like, yes, she should, but she's not. So it's okay. Over time, it all evens out. So if you, instead of like, I've got to talk to my cousin or go for a walk for 30 minutes, do it 10 minutes a day or every other day, whatever.
Just get it in.
Just get it in.
Yeah.
Yes, it'll be good for you.
Yeah.
Just like the spinach that I snuck into her. I forget how I did it. It was like a muffin. It was very ingenious.
As you were talking, I thought of jicama. Jicama is white.
Jicama is white.
It's got a lot of fiber for the next child.
Oh my God, no. Oh, no, I'm done. My youngest child is 170-pound Great Dane. That's it. I'm done. He's my third child, and no more humans are coming. Mm-mm.
You know, speaking of back to school, because it's back to school week for many of our children, it's such a challenge for us as mothers, right? To figure out what to feed our kids and how to feed our kids. And it's a challenge, figuring out the breakfast and the lunches. I actually have a lot of patients who will come in and who will talk about their kids and want to bring their children. And, You know, so much of what we do in our eating, just like everything else, is role modeling. Our children are watching us when we don't know it. And so actions speak really louder than words. And so I have my fair share of nagging my kids about what I think they should be eating, but I also have my fair share of just modeling what's in the house. And I'm mindful sometimes of what I want to eat and how that may be perceived, you know, do as I say, not as I do. And so modeling is so important, but also making small changes, you know, like your pediatrician said, incorporating once in a while, and our kids like us will develop habit. It becomes habitual.
Hold that thought. We have a caller. Hold on. Hi, caller. You're on with Dr. Nina and Dr. Udine. Welcome.
Hi, this is Larry. How are you both doing?
Hi, Larry. Hi. Welcome.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I like what I'm hearing about exercise in terms of starting slow. I know that if I say I'm going to go out and start running an hour for the first time, that's not going to last very long. But if I sort of lower the bar and set myself up for success by, as you say, going out and walking for 10 minutes or five or two, you know, I start off with success after success. And it brings up the question, from what either of you understand, you know, roughly how long it takes for something like that to become kind of an ingrained habit, or does that vary quite a bit?
You know, I don't know the cognitive behavioral data on that, you know, how long it takes to ingrain. Dr. Nina, do you have?
Well, I've heard 30 days, but I think everyone is different. So I don't know that there could be any, okay, do it for this long and then it will become a habit, because there may be different reasons that different people have for not incorporating something beneficial into their lives.
I will say this though, Larry, the 10-minute rule is not a bad rule. There's actually great data, a large population study that was done that demonstrated as little as 7 minutes of vigorous activity a day had mortality benefit. So people who exercise vigorously for 7 minutes a day lived longer, believe it or not, than people who did less than 7 minutes. So there is actually data that quantifies health benefit of physical activity. And another great study that has served as kind of the landmark of many of our recommendations is the Diabetes Prevention Program, or DPP, which showed that individuals who walked 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, were much less likely, 60% less likely to go on to develop type 2 diabetes, even in those who were taking metformin, which is a drug for diabetes. So the benefit of regular physical activity, even if it's modest amounts, can be so profound and significant.
Can I ask a question? Define vigorous activity.
That works. you know, it's for me, I think it's a lot of it is the power, what they call the power of intention, just wanting to get up and go. That alone probably makes a difference, but also obviously moving the body has a lot of benefits.
Yes, true.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I was just curious about that. I heard as little as a week, as much as a month, but there are so many variables. I guess it just depends. But
find out what works for you. Try 7 minutes every couple days and see how long it takes to become a habit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I run slowly, but I like it, and I do that several times a week, so I'm already started, but got to get out and do it just a little bit more. So
excellent.
Okay, just curious.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Larry.
Okay. All right. Thank you much. Before it gets too hot, I'm going to go running right now.
Okay. Enjoy. Sounds good. Good modeling. Bye.
Okay. There you go. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We actually had another caller that was on hold. Caller, can you hear me? Let's see. Hi, caller. You're on with Dr. Nina and Dr. Udine.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello?
Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi. Oh, hi. Nice to meet you. Yes. My name is...
Oh, sorry, you're dropping out. Sorry, I can't hear you. Can you call back? Okay, sorry about that.
In the meantime, can we answer your question about vigorous activity?
Oh, we have one quick caller on the line. Hold that thought.
Oh, good.
Hi, caller. You're on with Dr. Nina and Dr. Udeem. Welcome.
Hey, Dr. Nina. It's Brian from Chicago. How are you?
Hi, Brian from Chicago. Good.
I have more theoretical questions, but today, I think because of your guest, I have a practical question, which is bulletproof coffee. Is it good for you? Does it have actual health benefits, or is it more of a fad?
She just grimaced, so I'm going to guess.
I smiled.
That doesn't sound good.
Oh, smiled. She's
well, smiled. You know, first of all, let me say that when you're asking a physician about advice, we are very rigorous in how we make our recommendations, and it's based on data, not on anecdote. And I think it's my obligation to really refrain from spewing myth or anecdote. There is no data on this, and so I can't really say that there's a health benefit. I have to say, from an anecdotal perspective, though, I am all in favor of incorporating good fats in the diet, and there's much data to advocate for that. Avocados, nut.
Oh, hi, caller. You're on hold. Can you hold on? And when Dr. Udeem is finished with this question, we will get to you, but we can hear you now. Hold on.
So nuts and avocados and other sources of mono and polyunsaturated fats are great. I still have an issue with saturated fat. There are harmful effects for both weight as well as for cardiovascular health. And I think there are plenty of sources of fat in our diet. We don't need to get it in our coffee.
We don't need to put oil in our coffee. Okay. Good answer. Brian from Chicago, thank you so much. Thanks for calling in. And now, hi, caller, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi. Oh, we can hear you too. Welcome to the show. What's your name?
Yeah, my name is Jacqueline.
Hi, Jacqueline. What's your question for Dr. Udeem?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you because, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, okay. Perfect. Yeah, sorry, I'm in a bad connection here, so if you can just let me know.
Okay.
I just want to thank you, first of all, because since when I started listening to your show, I keep paying attention to myself a lot because I was a really bad dieter. I was constantly going on a diet, non-stopping.
Oh, Jacqueline, you're making me tear up. I'm so happy to hear this. Oh, that's so amazing.
Yeah.
I'm so glad.
For me, it was a big transformation because I never thought about working on my mind instead of just keep forcing myself going on a diet, always telling myself that I don't have willpower, that I can do anything right. And then once I started realizing what was causing those triggers, and then I noticed that my problem was I hated my job. I hated my career. I hated so much that was going on in my life. And then basically I just decided to quit. Just decided to quit my job. And then now I'm back to university. I'm studying kinesiology with something that I've done in the past. So
wow.
I just really, everything changed since when I started paying attention to myself and paying attention to my feelings. So I just really want to thank you for your show because it really opened my mind a lot about what was going on.
Jacqueline, I'm going to just cry right now. And I'm on Facebook Live, so you can actually see me getting all teary. That means so much to me. I am so thrilled to hear that my show has opened up your mind and introduced you more to yourself. And that's a beautiful thing to hear. So thank you.
Yeah, but I also have another question.
Okay.
School to start everything over again, and I'm 35 years old. Even just start over again for me, it was such a big impact. But then I thought, no, I live once, I'm going to move on because stop the dieting. I want to be living my life the way I want. But I'm also a mom of twins.
Wow.
My twins are 3 years old.
How old? Sorry, what, you keep going and, in and out a little bit.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'm actually a mom of twins. So I have, my twins are 3 years old and a boy and a girl. And then since when I decided to quit my job and live my life and look at them.
Oh, Jacqueline, I'm sorry. We keep losing you.
Yeah. Oh, can you hear me?
Hello? Yeah, I can hear just about every third word that you're saying. You know.
Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. If
can you?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah. You know what, Jacqueline? I am so sorry, but I think that we just have a terrible connection. Do you want to?
Okay.
If you can email me the question, I will be sure to answer it next week.
Okay.
As we just have a few more minutes here anyway. But did you have a question for Dr. Udeem since you're on with both of us? Okay, you have a question for me. Please write me. You can email me directly through my website. It's dr.nina, dr.nina at winthedietwar.com. Email me.
Okay.
I answer all my emails personally, and I will get it, and I will answer your question on the show, or you can call me back next week, too.
But, okay, sure, no problem.
But thank you for your beautiful call.
Okay,
bye. Oh, that must happen to you too, where you know you really change people's lives, and there's just no better feeling to help them create change in their lives, not just in their weight, but in their lives.
You know, I think something special about what we both do is that it's our profession to create relationships and connection. And to me, that's one of the fundamental joys of living, of being human. So, yeah, there is, I do take a lot of joy in making those connections with people.
Yeah, and the best way to feel good is to do good, I think. That is so much more powerful than whatever the number on the scale is, right? Something you cannot measure, you can only feel. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, let me see what time we have. Well, we have a few more minutes. So sorry, Jacqueline, if you're listening. I'm sorry we couldn't hear you, but I look forward to either hearing you from email or you calling in next week. What do you think is something that most people are unaware of? Like, can you think of any kind of idea that people come in like, to lose weight, I must exercise an hour a day, or some of the principles that people believe are truths but are myths when it comes to health and weight loss?
Well, I'll just share a few barriers. The exercise one is a barrier in thought or belief. The exercise is a good one because exercise is very important in weight maintenance, in that it helps promote that muscle mass and metabolism that we were talking about earlier in the show. But oftentimes I have patients who'll come in and say, you know, I started this new exercise regimen. I'm working out an hour, three times a week, four times a week, and I haven't lost weight, and so I want to give it up. The truth is that the weight loss piece is really 90 to 95% food and what you eat, and not so much what you expend. Not to dismiss the benefits of exercise, but the diet has to come first or has to be foremost in order for people to actually see the pounds come down. Another barrier I feel is the incorporation of good foods. So we were just talking about good fats like avocados and nuts and seeds. These are heart healthy. There are cognitive benefits. There are many health benefits to the good fats. But at the end of the day, they're very calorically dense. They are fat. And if they're consumed in excess, then they will get in the way of weight loss. And when people gain weight, then it obviates all those other health benefits. The weight gain is going to result in diabetes and other harms. So there can be too much of a good thing. And just because almonds are a good substitute for chips from a health perspective, one serving is about 12 almonds. That's about 100 calories, which is not very much if you think about it.
Yeah, I had, and I want to get to the question. I don't want to forget the vigorous exercise, you know, with definition. But I had a patient who just said, I cut out all chips. I don't have any crackers in the house. I'm eating almonds and pecans and this, and I'm gaining weight. What's wrong? And you know, it turned out that she was eating thousands of calories of nuts. So that is a good reminder that we still have to keep in mind what are the calories in these healthy foods. Vigorous exercise.
Right. So you're not going to be super satisfied with my answer. There are ways to quantify exercise based on something we call METs or metabolic equivalents. In general, though, vigorous exercise is something that's going to get your heart rate to about 80% of the maximum heart rate. So for most people, I'm going to say the 130 to 145s. I would say that a good measure for an individual is that point at which you are sweating and can't hold a full conversation. We would quantify that as moderate to vigorous exercise. That's more of a practical strategy or suggestion.
Okay, so forget the Fitbit. Just think about, can you speak, or are you gasping for breath? If so, you're in the vigorous zone.
Yeah, so we don't want to tell people to go from zero to 160 and be gasping, but probably shouldn't be having a conversation like we are right now. That wouldn't quantify as vigorous.
Okay, well, you know what? I'm satisfied with that answer.
Okay,
it works for me. It's very understandable. So listen, you've been so helpful as always, and I hope you'll come back again and answer more of these questions. How can people find you?
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. I love being on this show, and I think we are very like-minded, so it's a pleasure. And I can be found on Instagram at Dr. Adrian Udeem. I'm also on Facebook under the same name, and my website, dradrianudeem.com, dradrianeyoudim, has a lot of useful tips and information.
Yeah, it really does. So you guys have to check it out. And I want to thank you for being here today. And thank you, my guest. You were fabulous as always. And again, I'm here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, or you can listen later on iTunes or wherever you get podcasts. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.